Учения «Запад-2017» будут...
Российская Федерация полным ходом готовится к военным учениям «Запад-2017».
В них примут участие почти 13 тысяч военнослужащих.
Представители НАТО будут следить за белорусско-российскими
учениями. They've been called a stealthy way to occupy Belarus. They've been called Kremlin saber-rattling, a message to the West, and a very expensive and noisy psyop. And they've been called routine military exercises that are nothing more than business as usual. But whatever you call them, the joint Russian-Belarusian Zapad 2017 military exercises that begin next week seem to have everybody's attention. So what should we expect when we're expecting Zapad? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C. is military analyst Michael Kaufman, a research scientist at the CNA Corporation and a fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. Welcome back to the podcast, Michael.
Hey, great to join you, sir.
Great to have you. So Russian troops began arriving in Belarus in mid-August. And Michael, in a recent piece in War on the Rocks, the headline of which I shamelessly pilfered at the end of my monologue there because I liked it so much, you wrote something that stuck with me, something that I also pilfered for the Daily Vertical and credited you at the same time. You wrote that we shouldn't fear Zapad, we should learn from it. So what are you hoping to learn? What will you be watching for? What do you expect to see next week?
By the way, you're welcome to all that. Good analysts borrow, but the best analysts steal. I think, first and foremost, you know, Zapad ultimately is an opportunity, right? It's happening either way, whether we like it or not. It takes place now every 4 years on a rotation, as Russia rotates these strategic exercises between four strategic directions. And Zapad will reflect both, you know, advancements in Russian forces, their capabilities, their capacity to shift forces to the Baltic region, how well they've improved command and control, all the sort of nuts and bolts that military analysts look for. But a large part of Zapad is also a communication piece. It's a messaging piece, a way for Russia to establish coercive credibility with the United States and with NATO. And it's a pretty clear indication of, at least from my perspective, what bothers them the most, what are their sort of security concerns, what are their fears about possible Western designs, interventions, as fantastical as they may seem to us on Belarus, how they would react to it, how they think a crisis would escalate, how they would then apply escalation control, deploy conventional forces, and perhaps even nuclear forces. So a large part of this is really a conversation that Russia's trying to have with the United States, and frankly has been having this conversation with the United States ever since Zapad 1999.
But why so much attention on this? I mean, as you point out, they do Zapad every 4 years. They do one of these big exercises every year, right? Whether it's you, Kavkaz, they do one of them. Why all the hysteria, for lack of a better word, about these exercises that they're going to be used to occupy Belarus, that they're going to be used to launch an invasion on Ukraine or Poland or Lithuania? What's different about these?
Okay. Well, look, first and foremost, naturally, people, of course, worry when, you know, any major power has a large exercise and begins flexing its muscles like this. A part of it is that you get a lot of statements from senior military and political officials. And frankly, you know, you just have a large focus of media attention, right? You have a great deal of sensationalism. I think that, you know, these sort of events often lead very smart people to say very stupid things. And you hear a lot of that in the last month from senior NATO officials, for example, all sorts of sort of fantastical predictions, none of which have any factual basis whatsoever.
But isn't that part of the messaging too?
Well, I think it's certainly a distinct accomplishment on the Russian end. I hate to attribute that to them. I hate to attribute our failure to them as success, but I think that they're definitely happy with the outcome. So, you know, part of the messaging is, establishing that course of credibility and showing how much fear they can instill with a sort of exercise. I'm sure they're very pleased with it. But a lot of sensationalism, sort of self-flagellation on our part.
Mark, what are you hoping to learn from these exercises? What are you going to be watching for? What do you expect to see?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, very much agree with Mike's take that this is a combination of a perfectly sensible military exercise that exactly, for it to be of any use, the Russians have to basically war game the kind of war that they fear they might be fighting. You train for how you think you'll fight. And at the same time, it is a psyop, it is a conversation, it does exist in this realm. So, I mean, in that context, I would say, what am I going to be looking for? First of all, the exact way in which they frame the exercise. I mean, they've already done this by sort of creating these three fictional countries, by creating this scenario of the evil threat that comes from points west of on the compass, and to which they basically will deliver a devastating rebuttal. Well, you know, it's often going to be the detail. Essentially, which countries do they want particularly to give them a little scare, a little tweak? And particularly given that at the moment there is still, although I think it is actually probably coming off the boil, discussion in Sweden and Finland about joining NATO, or at the very least about sort of greater defence cooperation within the European Union. They might just want to do things that sort of the Swedes and the Finns, or at least elements of the Swedish and Finnish population, think, ouch, help, they're sort of pointing that the crosshairs will be on us if we get any closer. So what is the political messaging that we're going to get from the Russians during and after the exercise? We're going to get, obviously, the suitable amount of war porn, of tanks crashing through mud lakes and everything else to tell Russians just how wonderful it is, and certainly, you know, Sluzhu Rossiya is going to have a particularly good field day for my Saturday morning watching on Zvezda TV. But more generally than that, moving on from how the Russians are going to be trying to message it, it's also the question of the leverage. And here this comes back to the whole business of the hysteria. In part, it's exactly smart people saying stupid things because they're caught up in the moment and because the media are looking for those quotes. And let's face it, you can give them 50 smart and measured quotes, and then the 51st one, where you sort of, you know, go over that boundary point, is obviously the one they're going to print. But it's also the fact that actually people in the West have also been using this for political leverage. Exactly, yeah. You know, keeping up the pressure for the 2% of GDP spend on defence. When you've got to have some kind of a sort of credible threat in order to maintain the political momentum behind that. You have individual countries, such as Ukraine, that are clearly using this for leverage. This is why you must defend us, because basically we are in a constant existential threat. So that's a sort of second thing. Third and final point, though, is absolutely just from a purely technical point of view. We see how well these new, bigger structures, I mean, the First Guards Tank Army, which is one of these reconstituted high-order structures, is sort of the crucial element of the Russian deployment. So we're going to see how their armies and how their divisions actually move. Are these real structures, or are they just agglomerations of existing brigades?
What do you make of, because there has been a lot of hysteria out there, and I think some of it's been intentionally, like you mentioned, for political purposes, but one of the things that struck me is that the comments coming out of the Baltic states have been very measured. And you'd think these are the countries that have the most, that you would think would be the most hysterical about this. But yet the comments coming out of the Baltic states have been extremely measured, in my opinion, unless I'm missing something. Either of you on that, what do you make of that, Michael? Or,
you know, I think they are, and a little bit mixed. For example, Christian Prick, who's a good colleague, I think he's Undersecretary of Defense over in Estonia, has got very, very, very pragmatic, very measured and thoughtful views. He's a great Russia expert. Some senior political leaders have been, I think, a bit less thoughtful in things they've said. And my perspective is ultimately that, look, Baltic countries don't expect the Zapad or any other Zapad to necessarily be a prelude to, you know, a bolt from the blue Russian attack. And to be honest, it doesn't make much sense, because when you're having every 4 years a colossal strategic exercise, that's going to be the one time of the year when NATO is obviously prepared for any sort of surprise attack. So it's not very practical or logical.
Well, that's, you know, what they want you to think.
yeah, sure. Yeah, it's super deceptive. But look, the reality is that actually, you know, in this kind of strategic exercise, the real period of danger is after the exercise itself, right? And that's what history has shown. And Russia has a pretty checkered past in terms of using strategic operational exercises to either game out a potential conflict or as a cover to move forces and position them for some kind of military operation.
Yeah, and the two obvious examples are Kavkaz 2008, which was a predecessor to the invasion of Georgia, and the rapid deployment forces exercises that were near the Ukrainian border prior to the annexation of Crimea. Correct? Were there any other times when Russia's used these as a? Because it seems like the ghosts of Kavkaz 2008 are kind of haunting every big Russian exercise because of what happened after that one. No?
Yeah, absolutely. There are two slightly different cases. Kavkaz 2008 was where Russia worked out the units and the forces that would be involved in this whole provocation that they planned for Georgia. Although the irony of that particular episode is that the Russia-Georgia war actually went quite poorly for Russian forces. Terrible performance, and that's one of the things – that was the last nail in the coffin that pushed them towards launching the vast military reform effort, is because they actually planned it out, and it went disastrously anyway.
Mark, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, firstly, there's nothing new about this. I mean, if one looks at the invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, again, they used exercises as a way of masquerading, moving forces into sort of the relevant areas. So, you know, this is just the way it is. But precisely in the modern world with the level of scrutiny, as Mike says, this is not how you launch a surprise attack. Instead, it's again a question of just saying, well, what kind of a war do they envisage? But the bottom line is, look, further military operations against Ukraine are perhaps conceivable. We'll talk later about whether or not operations against a NATO country are at all likely. But the point is, this is actually something that does not just happen because they just made a decision 6 months or even 6 weeks ago. Let alone, I mean, these are very, very long-term processes that also are being played out, you know, in parallel exercises across much of the west of Russia. This is not just something that is happening in Belarus. In fact, what's happening in Belarus is a relatively small-scale operation, after all.
Right. Now, I want to go to Michael, because in your piece, What Should We Expect When We're Expecting Zapad, you had an interesting section there that I'd like to kind of flesh out here about what happens on Z-Day. You know, what happens? Walk us through this. What can we expect to see as these exercises get underway? Interest.
Right. All right, great question. So I think, of course, one of the misnomers about Zapad is that, you know, Zapad is actually just one particular exercise. But the reality is that Zapad is several things. One, it's a long regimen of exercises and trainings and various sort of simulations that take place throughout spring and summer leading up to the actual event. And a number of things that we're going to see in Zapad, Russian forces have already practiced in Belarus, meaning they've already been there earlier this year. The units that are going to be doing the actual exercise in the coming week in September have already practiced some of these elements in Belarus throughout summer and spring. Zapad itself is going to take place September 14th through 20th. Typically, this is a two-phase exercise. It takes place a bit over a week. Phase one will be about 3 days, and in that phase, Russian forces together with Belarusian forces in Belarus will be responding to what are basically hypothetical armed groupings, diversionary groups, and incursions sponsored by these three titular adversaries, who we know principally to be, you know, Lithuania, Latvia, and you know, another state that you can sub in as Poland or maybe United States. But suffice to say, a coalition of NATO countries. And then phase two will be, you know, once Russian forces together with Belarusian forces handle these diversionary groupings who are there to create some kind of color revolution, sabotage the regime and drive a wedge between Minsk and Moscow, phase two is the second part of that, which is the expectation that this is principally all a ruse by the United States to somehow intervene in Belarus and break Belarus away from Russia's sphere of influence. And that's going to be, you know, a much more classical, conventional, high-end fight where Russian forces will swing into gear, not just in Belarus or in the Baltic region or in Kaliningrad or around St. Petersburg, But the Russian military will begin exercising across Russia, Western military district, other military districts, different fleet commands, and they will be preparing for what is a potential high-end fight with an adversary, right? And then you're going to basically see the next several days of that, of them playing out a what might be a conventional contingency against not necessarily NATO, by a U.S.-led coalition of NATO, consisting of NATO countries. And Zapa will not end on the 20th. That's the myth, too. There'll be other exercises that follow on from that. And if there's, let's say, a nuclear escalation piece to this, something where Russian general purpose forces or dual use forces or even strategic forces come into play, they may do some follow on exercises after Zapad itself. And you should see a number of multinational exercises that are all tied into this piece as well, meaning there'll be a host of military activity that runs from September through October, probably till early November.
Mm. Mark, anything to add to this?
Just as one very minor point, piggybacking on this notion that this is actually a whole constellation of different exercises, which often have slightly different roles within the sort of wider thing. Basically, they're trying to see how Russia can mobilize precisely against a high-end adversary. So first of all, when we hear figures like, oh, there'll be 100,000 troops involved, we should be stressing that actually a lot of those are going to be civil defense workers who are going to be testing how they deal with bombing raids, or National Guardsmen sitting in barracks ready to deploy or whatever. So, I mean, in that respect, 100,000 is rather
let's pick up on that just for a second before you finish your point, because this is something I did want to address. Russia says there's going to be 12,700, which is conveniently just below that 13,000 threshold that they need to invite observers. Western officials say it's up to 100,000. How many are actually going to be participating in the Zapad exercises that are the Zapad exercises, not all the adjuncts and annexes to it?
Well, if Mike is going to give you a much more informed answer than me, so let me just sort of say something pointless and then he can correct me. I mean, if Zapad means the sort of the real, as it were, the Belarus focused element, I think those actually figures of just under 13,000 are probably accurate.
Uh-huh. Michael, would you agree with that? That the 12,700 figure for the part of Zapad that actually is Zapad in Belarus, is that an accurate figure?
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, I don't think Russians are planning to transport much more than about 3,000 troops. Belarusians said that of the exercise total they're declaring, they expect about 10,000 plus soldiers on their territory. 7,000 of that's from them, and 3,000 of that's from Russia. And Russia doesn't look like it's logistically prepared to throw much more than several thousand into Belarus for that very specific piece of the exercise, keeping in mind that that's really phase one of the exercise and not the big conventional high-end fight and all that.
So when you bring all that in, the number does get up closer to 70,000, 80,000.
Well, right. So here's the issue. It all depends on how you count, right? And here, I got to be frank, who you talk to can give you a different answer, because are you counting all the various Russian forces in the Baltic region? Like, let's say 6th Army, 20th Army,
right.
1st Tank Army, some elements of which will be involved, the Army Corps in Kaliningrad, the fleet. Is that what you're counting? Are you counting all the forces in the Western Military District, right, which is colossal? And the Northern Fleet, the Arctic District, you're counting that. That might get you up towards, definitely 50 to 70,000. Are you counting all the Russian forces throughout Russia they're drilling as part of this as far back as, the Far Eastern Military District and the Pacific Fleet? Because the way they got the number of 100,000, beyond just making it up. I'm no offense to New York Times, but yeah, I think that number was woven out of whole cloth. So people estimate that Zapad 2013 had about 70,000 Russian troops involved in it. But they are counting basically all the troops pretty far away from the Baltic region who were engaged in these series of exercises associated with the actual Zapad scenario. And it's important to understand that the second phase of that scenario for Russia is really how Russia as a country responds to a high-end conventional fight with the United States. Then there were 20,000 Ministry of Interior troops throughout Russia that fan out, and they handle all sorts of partly what Mark said, civil defense infrastructure. But the other part of it is what we're going to see again in this exercise is the National Guard coming out and handling efforts to destabilize Russia itself, suppressing, you know, protests, and handling what they will think will be various forms of political warfare against Russia to create instability for the regime. And that number of, you know, National Guardsmen throughout Russia could well exceed 20,000. So when you rack and stack that, that's how people get to maybe 100,000 people involved. But it kind of gets confusing because then people in defense news write things like, Russian exercise will put 100,000 troops on NATO's borders, which it will not.
Right. Well, where did I want to go? I want to go this scenario that we've been all referring to throughout, the scenario of three outside powers, Vaishnoria, Besbaria, and Lubin, which are clearly two Baltic states and Poland. What does this scenario really show us about Russia's thinking? Does Russia think that NATO, this is a real threat, that NATO is going to intervene in Belarus to try to dislodge it from Russia? Is that really part of their thinking right now?
Well, I mean, do they think it's about to happen? No, absolutely not, I don't think. But on the other hand, look, two things. One is militaries have to train for worst-case scenarios, up to a point. I mean, I don't think they necessarily train too much on aliens sort of descending upon Moscow or whatever. But, you know, but broadly speaking, the job of the military is not to be unprepared. And given that NATO is a formidable antagonist from their perspective, this is much more likely than some sort of blitzkrieg, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, this also is a useful scenario to allow them to precisely to test a whole range of different capabilities and responses. You want to have an exercise which is going to allow you to sort of, as Michael has described, segue from this sort of counter-diversionary, anti-guerrilla, etc., security-type operation, all the way up to a full-scale
conventional
war against a high-end antagonist. So anyway, you have to have a scenario that is going to do that for you. So I think this does do that. And I think the final point I'd make is it's something that we often have trouble really getting a head around, the extent to which actually there are a lot of people within the Russian security establishment, within the Kremlin and so forth, who genuinely regard NATO as threatening, who regard NATO as essentially America's Warsaw Pact, and think that America could actually at some point seek to not necessarily invade Russia, but certainly deploy forces in order to support elements which are trying to break away from Russia's sphere of influence. As far as they're concerned, you know, Euromaidan, after all, was made in Langley. So in that context,
I thought it was made in Foggy Bottom.
Well, I mean, when it comes down to the hard edge, anyway, we all know that Langley controls Foggy Bottom. But the thing is that from that perspective, this may seem very outre to us, but it's just simply a kind of an extrapolation from their point of view.
Michael, what does this scenario tell you about Russia's thinking, about their strategic thinking?
I actually think the scenario itself is quite interesting. It's not too different from Zapa 2013, but ultimately it reflects some pretty important strains in Russian strategic thinking of what they expect to be the source and point of conflict with the West. One, it's almost a mirror scenario to the kind of worst-case scenario that NATO plans for and worries about, which is the potential Russian threat, as low probability as it may be, to the Baltic states. Russia's version of the Baltic high-end fight is them defending in Belarus against a hypothetical incursion. Two, it's really interesting because it's very clear that Russia actually doesn't plan to fight NATO. It plans to fight a coalition of countries in NATO led or supported by the United States. And there's a very nuanced cognitive dissonance there, because I find, for example, in Washington, D.C., when we say NATO, we mean Europe. But in Europe and in Russia, when people say NATO, they mean the United States. Mm. That's actually a philosophical point of agreement, both between Europeans, I think, and the Russians. So when Russians say no, what they really mean is the United States. That's the primary concern. Nobody in Russia stays up at night worrying that Spain is going to come take Belarus from them, right?
Right.
Not worried about the collection of NATO countries. And if you look at the scenario, it's indicative that they believe that the interaction sort of with Poland or a couple of Baltic states over a crisis in Belarus is what ultimately then gets the United States involved and will lead to this crisis and confrontation and eventually an actual potential conflict between Russia and the U.S. So it's a bit revelatory in that regard. And then the scenario itself, as it plays out, shows what Russian strategy is. And I'm happy to talk a bit more about this, but as I wrote in the article, that Russia has over years has kludged together this version of a phase model for how they would deal with the United States from over the course of crisis to actual conflict to initial period of war, breakout of hostilities, even out through nuclear escalation. They call it strategic deterrence. And this is a concept that integrates both various military and non-military means of national power, at least conceptually, because, you know, it's very nice to brief on PowerPoint, but it rarely, things like that almost never walk off of PowerPoint into real life cleanly. And this scenario will show you how Russians think that they will employ these different instruments to, you know, coerce the West, and then as the conflict emerged, to control escalation, and then eventually to end hostilities on terms largely favorable to them. So this is a system that they modeled. This is what they're going to model throughout the exercise. Another part of it that you'll see that we've been touching on here and there in our conversation is how Russia as a state, as one national organism, mobilizes for a large-scale conflict, which involves a whole host of both military activities, political activities, and integration of civil defense, command and control between the military and domestic governance structures for what is ultimately, you know, a total war.
Now, Michael, you said also that the danger point in these things is not during the exercises, but after. And Kavkaz certainly teaches us that this lesson. Is there any reason to believe that there is danger after these exercises? Ukraine's been raising alarm bells about this, but I guess one would expect Ukraine to raise alarm bells about this. Is there any danger after the fact? I mean, there have been different scenarios played out that this would be used as a springboard to attack Ukraine, that this would be, or to escalate the existing war in Ukraine, that it would be used as a pretext to keep Russian forces in Belarus and thereby menace the Baltics and Poland. Is there anything that to make us believe that after the exercises we should be a little bit nervous and remain vigilant?
Well, look, I think there's always cause for vigilance and prudence, especially when somebody declares a large combined armed strategic exercise and they tell you when it's going to happen, and you know it's going to involve a substantial amount of forces throughout Russia. These are always periods of concern. That being said, yeah, naturally, a lot of the things that are being said about this don't make much sense, right? And you know, I, of course, don't want to disparage Ukrainian colleagues, but they're always sounding the alarm about all sorts of things. It makes absolutely no sense. Why would Russia, you know, go through Belarus and all the way around to invade Ukraine when it's already invaded Ukraine and is in Ukraine? Nor do I think that some of the other fantastical theories that, you know, Russians are going to invade, occupy Belarus, and they're going to forget to leave. Like, they're going to leave 3,000 soldiers shivering in the cold in Belarus as we get into October and November. That doesn't make a lot of sense either. But those theories aside, I think we should think about, you know, the possibility that in this scenario, of course, Russians are going to be working out various strategies of how they're going to get forces into the Baltic region. One. Two, how if there's a crisis in Belarus, they will ultimately intervene in Belarus, whether or not Belarus invites them or not. Because although the hypothetical scenario that we're dealing with here is the crisis being spawned from an intervention by members of NATO, the reality of it is that even if there is nobody, if there's a crisis in Belarus and there's no, it's not externally sponsored, and Russia feels compelled to intervene to secure its interest in Minsk, then they will definitely declare that whatever the popular protest or uprising in Belarus is, that is, you know, externally funded and supported by the United States, and that's going to be the causes belli for their intervention / occupation.
And they're going to deal with it the same way as if that were indeed the case.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and look, Lukashenko understands this in Belarus. Right? One thing, I think the dictators are very reliable in the sense that they have a very strong nose and sense for when they think somebody might subvert their actual regime and their authority. They're the ones looking out for themselves first and foremost, so it's not like he's a fool, like he doesn't understand, right? They're very well attuned to the possibilities. He understands who, you know, Belarus understands who they have a union state with and who he lives next to, right? So I do think that after the actual exercise period itself, which although officially ends September 20th, as I said, there'll be lots of other military events and ongoings beyond that into October, probably into November, that, you know, there is always a cause for vigilance, because just like Kafkaz 2008 was followed quickly then by a provocation in Georgia, there is a, you know, reason to very minor cause for concern and prudence of vigilance in that regard. But I definitely would not overstate it.
Mark, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I very much agree that I don't think we need to be worrying, particularly at the moment. And we should be wary of treating Kafkaz too sort of crucially. I mean, you know, we only have a couple of data points that actually there is going to be a risk. And in the case of Kafkaz, it was already scheduled, and they're obviously going to use it to the fullest advantage. More broadly, to go back to the point Mike made about the fact that this is about sort of total national mobilization, I think one of the interesting things is going to be things like how the central bank is again involved to sort of combat the expectation of Western economic and financial warfare. And in some respects, I mean, I think that for me is the only concern. It's a very long-term and diffuse one. It is, what lessons does Moscow gain from these exercises? Now, of course, the Russian side, I think I'm willing to push the boat out and suggest that the Russian side is going to win these exercises. but that's always going to be the case. But the question of, obviously, once they have their postmortems and so forth, my concern is that we are in a situation where there are a lot of exceedingly efficient and effective professional soldiers and so forth who know exactly the situation, the calculus of power. But it's how far their findings get fed properly up the decision-making chain. I'm hoping that actually the outcome of this is that they'll work out, well, this is how we would operate against a much, much tougher antagonist to give us the best chance of success, or at least of coercing an end that we would like. One of the concerns we have is that often actually the Kremlin makes policy based on miscalculations, misunderstandings of the situation. We saw that in terms of the political calculations around the Donbass or whatever. So it'll be interesting to see, not just obviously in the initial press, we know what that's going to say,
right,
but with the later and more serious postmortems and analyses of quite what political messages the Kremlin gets. Because I don't think the Kremlin has currently plans to, oh, well, once we've tested it out with Zapad, we will then go and invade Estonia or whatever. But on the other hand, if bad judgments are made about the implications of the exercise, that could feed into bad judgments being made about politics. But that's just something to wait and see.
Right. Now, before we move on to the second half, there is one thing I did want to touch on. We've kind of alluded to it here and there. But the different way that Belarus and Russia are approaching these exercises. Now, I wrote about this a couple of weeks back. About the in a lot of ways, I think the Belarusian-Russian relationship shows us the limitations of Russia's imperial model in the former Soviet space. Because you say Russia's often accused of trying to turn Ukraine into Belarus. Well, guess what? Belarus already is Belarus, and it's not that obedient, right? Now, there's been a transparency gap, or at least there's been an appearance of a transparency gap. And maybe you guys can help me out with this, because from where I'm looking at it, it looks like Belarus is trying to be a lot more transparent about this, trying to brief more, trying to bring more observers in. Russia, to the extent that it's doing it at all, is doing it grudgingly. So and this has been interpreted by some analysts as a kind of a safety measure by Belarus. By making these exercises as transparent as possible, they could forestall any of these scary Kremlin scenarios of a, you know, stealth occupation of Belarus that none of us seem to think is going to happen anyway. But what do you make of the different ways that these two countries are approaching this? Michael, what do you think?
Good question, Brian. I think that, look, Belarus is obviously in a somewhat difficult position, in that the Belarusians understand that from NATO perspective, they're largely viewed as the plotsdarm for potential projection of Russian military power into the Baltic region or the Suwalki Gap. They're trying to be transparent about that to NATO and to the West to the extent that they can. They have to manage the security concerns and considerations of their very, very powerful neighbor with a very, very clearly established track record of when it's concerned that it's going to lose this country that it sees as a core interest in its sphere of influence, that it will it will invade them, right? So they're forced to balance between these different imperatives because obviously Lukashenko understands living next to a dragon, and he has to find a way to both maintain his own, you know, control over Belarus sovereignty to the extent that he can, while also being demonstrating that he's a reliable, dependable ally to Russia, and that then in the event of a conflict or crisis with the West, that Russia has nothing to worry about, that he's going to be on their side, that they don't have to be concerned about the absence of strategic depth or that Belarus would turn against them. So I think Belarus naturally is both doing, by and large, most of what Russia would like it to do, but also signaling to the West that, look, you we don't want to preclude or close off any of our options for Western relations, and we don't want you to also think of us as just a 100% appendage of Russia either, because ultimately, you know, they want to have their own country and be able to have some kind of foreign policy that outside of Russia's foreign policy. And the current confrontation between Russia and the West has made it a lot more difficult to play some of these, I think, it's made it challenging and dangerous to play both sides or to play both ends of the fence. I hope that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Mark, what do you make of the transparency gap or the alleged transparency gap in the way these two countries are approaching the issue?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. This is about Minsk trying to signal something to the West about its own sort of autonomy. And in that respect, I mean, it's a symptom of this much, much wider issue. I mean, we saw this, for example, with the opening up of the visa requirements, which actually caught the Russians by surprise and annoyed them, because they meant they then had to actually introduce new kind of controls at airports for people flying in from Minsk. We saw this over the often quite bare-knuckled haggling on energy prices, on agricultural products and so forth.
And the new airbase.
Well, the new airbase, again, was an interesting thing. You know, the Russians wanted to have an airbase, but again, it's not actually that Minsk wants to challenge the Russians. I mean, they sort of said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll take some new, more jets. So that actually, well, I mean, no, because in a way that the issue is precisely about filling a perceived
a
air defense gap.
No, a perceived
gap.
Need, yeah.
So they're saying, look, we'll do it. So you don't actually have to deploy your own guys. We will do it.
Don't you think that has something to do with the fact that they don't want another Russian base in Belarus?
Well, of course. I mean, they've made that clear. But again, they're not just simply going to say no.
Right.
They're going to say, well, we don't really want that. Here's something that, again, suits your at least ostensible needs. You know, again, it is this question of Belarus, like pretty much every other post-Soviet state in what Russia considers its sphere of privileged interest, is not actually a friend of Moscow. They are having to deal with, as you know, as Mike put it, you know, with the dragon next door. So of course you actually have to sort of adapt your policies around it. You'll see what you can screw out of the dragon. You know, if you can pilfer a bit of the hoard and say, go on, you know, give us some, right, some jets or some cheap energy or whatever, that's great. But at the same time, you're seeing how far you can build autonomy, and it doesn't matter if you're Astana or Minsk. You know, you're still trying to work out how
Astana has a lot more cards to play.
Astana has a lot more cards to play. Well, yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, you know, Lukashenko is a very, very canny card player.
Yes, he is.
So it's a question of pluses and minuses. But we've certainly moved a long way away from the days when Lukashenko was desperately pushing for ever closer union with yeah, Russia. And so I think this is where it fits into. In strategic terms, I don't think there's any great significance to the fact that the sort of Belarusians brought in lots more observers. Politically, it's far more significant.
Yeah. No, it's, as I've described it, the emperor meets the gamer, right? In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look closer at that Russian military that'll be on display next week. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is military analyst Michael Kaufman, a research scientist at the CNA Corporation and a fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Наши вооруженные силы имеют огромный боевой потенциал.
Россия увеличила расходы на оборону на 6%, несмотря на дефицит бюджета.
Вооруженные силы России сегодня поступили новые самолеты, корабли, подлодки, крылатые
ракеты. Владимир Путин подписал указ об
увеличении штатной численности России. With 845,000 active duty soldiers, it has the fifth largest standing military in the world behind China, the United States, India, and North Korea. And, of course, with 1,750 active warheads and 6,970 total warheads, it boasts the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. After years of post-Soviet decline, Russia has also embarked on an ambitious modernization of its armed forces. We talk a lot on this program about how Russia poses a political and non-kinetic threat to the West. Is it now also becoming a serious military threat, Michael?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in some respects, it always was, at least when it comes to Russia's strategic nuclear deterrent. But and people often forget that Russia is still the only country that, you know, can destroy the United States in 35 minutes if it has a particularly bad and nihilistic day. But that aside, the truth is that, you know, for quite a few years, Russian military reforms, which were launched late in October of 2008, and then Russia's modernization program, which began to be implemented in 2011, the gains and the results of them were somewhat ignored or overlooked, and they began to yield tangible results for transforming Russian armed forces, which, while still half-baked and have quite a long way to go, there's been a fair bit of internal balancing on Russia's side, in terms of bringing its conventional military back as a pretty useful instrument of national power. And we've seen its utility and application in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, now in Syria. So the long story short on that is, yeah, actually, while we should not over-aggrandize Russian military capability, and there are clear limitations in what that military design is up to do, I won't get into the weeds too much unless that's the direction you'd like to go in. The truth is that in the Baltic region or along Russia's borders, actually, Russia's a pretty capable military adversary, and it should be because it's a Eurasian land power. It always has been, and they've put quite a bit of money and effort. And so that $70 billion budget that you pointed out, here's the truth on it. That budget's not counted in billions because Russia doesn't buy anything from the West. It doesn't buy in dollars. Russia buys in rubles. And so the base Ministry of Defense budget, 2.86, I think, trillion rubles, plus a lot of other trillions in security spending, that buys a lot. The purchasing power parity of that inside Russia buys you quite a bit of hardware, quite a bit of manpower. The size of Russian armed forces has been expanding year on year. Russia's military formations have been increasing in size. They've been deploying a lot more modernized equipment and some newer equipment. And, you know, so the truth is that when you look at where Russia's defending spending is and what Russia's state armament program, the procurement program, was able to deliver, it's pretty substantive. I think that we should not say it's either or, that Russia is either just a threat from the perspective of political warfare, unconventional warfare, or a military threat. The truth is, it is a great power. It's both. It has those capacities as a spectrum of both military and non-military means to engage in geopolitical competition and confrontation with the West. And most importantly, it is very much that military power that backs up coercive diplomacy and backs up various either political warfare campaigns or other approaches that are asymmetric, unconventional in nature. And is that deployment of military power that you saw, let's say, during the Operation Tanix Crimea, right, that was very convincing in support of what is principally an irregular warfare effort, right, that your ability to compel your neighbors with your conventional military power and to employ them alongside other means, you know, it's effective.
So if you figure in the purchasing power parity, where does that put Russia? Does it leapfrog it over Saudi Arabia, over China?
Absolutely. I mean, okay, Saudi Arabia is a bit of an aberration. Saudi Arabia's defense budget, just to be clear, is intermixed with a lot of spending on Saudi royals. You have no idea what they're really buying, how much of that defense budget is even buying military equipment versus Mercedes 600s. I'll be frank. You know, so that's a bit of a misnomer. Yes, Saudis are spending a lot on defense, but a lot of times how they spend on defense is pretty questionable in terms of what that really yields for military capability. On the other hand, here's the truth. Well, Russians buying rubles, so if the exchange rate drops 40-50%, doesn't mean the Russians' defense budget got halved, does it, right? It's still, right? So the truth is that what eats away Russia's defense budget is inflation. It's the standard rise in costs of production procurement. And in some respects, it's the budget cuts. They're averaging a 6% cut in the defense budget over the course of the next 3 years, but it may well rise after 2019. That defense budget buys you quite a bit. It's quite possible the Russian armed forces today are up to 900,000 strong in size altogether. In terms of modernized equipment, they've been deploying and modernizing quite a bit across the force, starting what they call the Southwest Strategic Direction, which is around Ukraine to the south, and now this year and the coming years moving further north to the Baltic region and the high north. So if you look across the board, in terms of military modernization, Russia's actually doing okay. They're doing reasonably well, and they're demonstrating the results of their procurement program. Although, given the economic condition of Russia, some of their bigger dreams, wilder ambitions are obviously not going to be realized.
Mm-hmm. Mark, a military threat? I bet you're going to say something about intent.
Well, I'll come to intent. But first of all, I mean, let me flutter my dovish wings for a moment. And sure, there is not direct purchase power parity, which is probably just as well for the Russians, given that, I mean, what theirs is $70 billion. I think the U.S. defense budget for next year is reckoned to be $825 billion.
Yeah.
And although, for example, the Saudis with their 13% of GDP spend, absolutely a lot of that is wasted. I would suggest that a fair amount of Russia's spend is also wasted on building sort of dachas for generals, mistresses, general sort of embezzlement and such like. But nonetheless, yes, absolutely, this is by no means an inconsiderable military force. It has modernized really quite effectively. I mean, it's still, you know, 50% conscripts serving 1 year tours of duty, which are really not very. So you've really only got them for about 3 months, where they're sort of at full skill level and so forth. But nonetheless, you know, if one looks at how they've operated, they have surprised us. They've surprised us with Syria, with their capacity not just to deploy there, but to sustain that operation. They surprised us with how neatly they took Crimea, even if that was a particularly sort of unique situation. But precisely, this is also a defence budget, which even in its own terms is falling year on year at the moment. To meet their own targets, they would have had to increase it. And Putin recently said that procurement will not be affected by these cuts. Right. Well, that means that the cuts have to come somewhere else. And therefore, it might well start eating into whether it's training, whether it's maintenance, whether it's conditions for soldiers. They still have trouble getting in enough professionals. It's got to come from somewhere. And part of the thing about the defense budget is that it is, like all defense budgets, not simply a way of making your military better. It is actually a way of funneling money to the defense industries who have the best lobbyists, or in the Russian case, actually have the greatest political priority. Mm-hmm. You know, again, we come back to how many Russian officers were actually saying that the T-14 Armata tank, for example, is the tank that they really wanted, and how far was that just the tank that Ural Vagon Zavod wanted to sell?
So this goes back to the old debate, whether you buy Russian kit or foreign kit, that goes back to the
generally what you need. So, okay, I mean, I'm just throwing in some limits, but at the same time, absolutely, they're spending between 5 and 6% of GDP, or put another way, about 30% of the federal budget goes on security in one form or another, and in one sort of category or another. So this is something that is clearly, you know, a priority for this government, and as a result, they have developed capabilities. But of course, we come to this issue of precisely capability versus intent. It's like saying, could the U.S. Marine Corps take the Republic of Ireland? Well, I suspect the answer is yes. So the question is, when you've got a military threat, the answer is inevitably to whom? If it's to NATO, well, it's worth mentioning that European NATO actually has more troops, more armed, you know, ground forces than the Russians. Then, okay, fair number of them are Turks. When there's political issues there, they're not all sort of sitting on the border. A lot of them are configured for light intervention roles. But still, you know, we shouldn't think that the West has been sitting back and not also been arming and preparing. So I think I would want to bring it back to this point that Mike made about the extent to which its military capabilities, its very real military capabilities, and especially its military capabilities hyped up, whether it's through Zapad, whether it's through alarmist Western accounts or arms traders who want to sell the latest missile or whatever, does provide a very powerful supplement to its non-kinetic capacities. You know, it wouldn't be able to do as many things if there was not also this constant sort of backdrop. And when it comes down to it, I would suggest that one of the key operational functions of the Russian military is not to fight a war with NATO. It's not to fight a war with China. It's actually to maintain Russia's regional hegemonic status. It's actually so that, and until recently, and until sort of, you know, Ukraine, you know, it could basically say, if you mess with us, ultimately, even if we do it very clumsily and nowhere near as effectively as we should have, but nonetheless, we will come and we'll ruin your day.
As they did in Georgia.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of as, yeah, they are certainly, if not ruining, but certainly, I think it's fair to say, casting a cloud over the Ukrainians' day as well. But generally, I mean, it is a power that gives you the strength to be a regional bully rather than a global military superpower.
Michael? I feel like I got Kenan and Nitsa here in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Does that make me Truman? I don't know.
Brian, that's a tall order. I would never aspire to such a role, but I will tell you that Kennan always lost to Nitsa for good reason, because you don't need a $600 billion defense budget to fight a principally political threat. That being said, I agree with the thrust of Mark's assessment about some of the intent. I don't agree with some of the nuts and bolts of how he put it together, because, look, principally, any defense budget, procurement budget, how you build a military is negotiation between, you know, what kind of missions and roles that you want for your military, but also what your defense industry can produce, what wants to produce. It's not very different at all from how we do things in the West. With our defense budget, there's a lot of things that we buy where you ask, what was that really for? That being said, look, the Russian military is, yes, it's both spending things on in ways that supports the defense industry, but it is also producing a very large amount of modernized equipment and a host of new capabilities that have fairly specific missions. Now, Mark is right. Principally, Russia's like a regional hegemon. And in that regard, Russia has developed a military that's going to be the first with the mostest to any point of conflict on its borders, one. And two, in terms of just basic Russian good enough, even if their wildest procurement dreams don't come true, they're completely unnecessary because, you know, the conflict in Ukraine quite demonstrated that, you know, Russian good enough is more than sufficient to deal or handle any former Soviet republic or most threats that it could potentially come up against in its region. Beyond that, you know, in terms of the future of Russian military, look, there is a lot intertwined in both the regime's legitimacy from my perspective and the domestic public perception of the Russian military today, sort of the pride in Russian military, Russian military underpinning this new perception of Russia as a great power in the international system, as a player outside of its region, the Middle East. And so that's in some ways tied, I think, the regime to sustaining defense spending, whereas they would have, if they were more pragmatic, would have cut it more for the simple reason that now they can't. That's one of the few sort of leading lights in Russian domestic politics and on Russian news, all the things that the Russian military is doing in Syria. So it's a bit hard for them to cut it back now. Looking forward, look, intent is very hard, and it's actually one of the most frustrating conversations you can have as an analyst because it's a perpetual debate. So as an analyst, you know, I derive intent from the capabilities the Russia procures, from its force posture, from its structure, where they're basing units, how they exercise, and, you know, ultimately you can paint a picture and say that it's pretty clear that, you know, the Russian military is not set up or designed to, for example, invade the Baltics, right? And Mark is right in what he said, that NATO is still the preeminent defensive alliance in the world, and almost a bit crazy for us to take it on. Okay, that being said, policymakers, decision makers, they basically hear everything you say, and they're not even remotely interested because they derive intent by characterizing the other leader's behavior. So they may hear everything you said, that, look, Russia does not have an operational reserve. The Russian ground force is actually fairly small, and it's not set up or designed to occupy large amounts of terrain, which is why they only invaded a tiny percentage of Ukraine and can't possibly hope to take or hold more ground than that. And they hear that say, listen, Vladimir Putin, you know, he's a risk taker, very dangerous guy, seems very aggressive. We don't know what he's going to do. We cannot divine intent. We have to prepare and plan always for capability. So as an analyst, I can confidently show you how you lose that fight pretty regularly, because on your end, you have all these facts. And on the other side, there's a news story about how Russia's going to put 100,000 troops on NATO's borders next week. And it's very, very dangerous. And it's going to be on all the news, major news networks and newspapers. And your argument ultimately goes nowhere.
Mark?
In some ways, unfortunately,
I'm not sure you guys disagree
Kennan and
that
Nitsa,
much.
Exactly,
first of all.
This is early Kennan and Nitsa.
Yeah,
this is when they were still chums. I think we are very much sort of talking about the same thing, just from different perches.
Mm-hmm.
Mike absolutely is talking about this from a sort of the point of view of a military analyst in one of the most kind of politically intense capitals of the world, and I'm in Prague. I think you're closer to the threat geographically. Yeah, exactly. And yet I sleep at night. I think I would actually sort of, there is one point, because after all, there's no fun if we are agreeing. One area in which I would actually manage to sort of pull out some disagreement from the amity is I would agree that in a way the issues of Putin's legitimacy and the defense budget and so forth are intertwined. But in some ways, I would actually flip it the other way around. See, I don't see a huge amount of evidence to suggest that Russians are really that concerned. Of course, you throw lots and lots of war porn on TV, and they're happy to see that they're, you know.
Well, I would say it's bearing itself out in the polls. It's bearing itself out in the polls. Recent Levada polls showed that Russians are increased discontent with the domestic political situation. Mm-hmm. Alexei Levinson had a great interview about this in Vedomosti. But the approval of foreign affairs and security policy is sky high.
But if you look at that, they don't want forces to stay there. I mean, actually, people want their forces out, the majority. On balance, this is one of those things where no one says, would you like to have weak military? Would you like your forces to be defeated? And so forth. Of course not. But on the other hand, what actually are people really concerned about? They're concerned about bread and butter issues. No one is actually sitting there saying, I would be absolutely fine for my kid to have a worse life than me, so long as the Russian military
then
get a lot more
armor. Then how do you explain the Crimea effect? And how do you explain the
Crimea was one very, very specific case.
And that increasing numbers of Russians are expressing discontent with the domestic political situation. They believe the system's unjust. They believe they're getting screwed. They believe there's too much corruption. And yet, if you look at the last Levada poll, and I actually checked it before I came into the studio, 57% say the country's on the right track. 57.
Come on, it's a lot. This is a little bit like the whole business of Putin's approval ratings. You know, it's vastly more complex than just simply, oh, well...
Well, those are in the 80s.
It's not actually as if it's a straightforward, oh, well, average it out. You know, they are much more sort of comfortable with foreign policy.
But I would argue that it's foreign policy that's pulling this up, I would believe.
It's pulling this up, but on the other hand, it's pulling this up from things that are in many ways the product of that foreign policy. They're not necessarily saying the miserable quality of my life, the concerns I have about the quality of life of my kids is because of foreign policy. They're talking about it because there's a lack of investment in social infrastructure. It's about the pension funds. It's about all these other various things. However, the point is that if we look at it, actually, why is there not
it's because of the corruption.
Well, the corruption. But anyway, the corruption was there before. It was just in the good times, there was the money for guns and butter. So people got used to actually things getting better. Nowadays, these are not the good times. The money is going on the guns and not the butter.
As it always has.
And exactly. And people are saying, where's my butter? They aren't yet making that connection. They aren't actually at the point
saying...
But you
think they will?
Well, I don't even think they will. I don't think they even have to. It's just the point is, the more that they're pissed off because of the quality of their life, and the more that poor quality of life is a product of this kind of spending, and also other kind of costs, such as the impact of sanctions and so forth, as a result of foreign adventure, the more they're just pissed off in their own right.
Well, I'll let you finish your point, because you were saying you agree with Michael on the connection between the legitimacy and the...
Yeah, but I sort of point the arrow a different way. Rather than saying military success and military spending are crucial because Russians reassure themselves with the fact that they have great military, even if their lives are bad. I think that actually, even if the connection is not being made, that there is a delegitimating process because of the spending and because of the impact of the adventures.
Mm. Michael, very last word to you before we wrap it up, as we're bumping up against time.
Sure. I mean, I do hate to end on a disagreement, but I think these are great nuanced points. So I think, Mark, one thing that you're missing in your analysis, look, the military that Russia's developing and deploying is not just for regional fights. It is deploying a conventional military capability, a force that is designed to provide itself with some good escalation buffers and a strategy such that it can impose pretty respectable costs on the United States and NATO in a conventional fight without resorting necessarily to having to use nuclear weapons. And Russia had always wanted to try to wean itself off of overdependency on nuclear weapons as its only deterrent and real answer and argument to, you know, overwhelming U.S. conventional military power. One thing that's not exactly true is that NATO has been really investing in its military capability the past several years. Actually, for most of the past decade, while Russia had been engaging in military reforms and modernization, NATO had been very effectively at the same time completely demilitarizing itself and developing their militaries along niche roles and capabilities like counter-piracy, peace enforcement, counter-insurgency, and counter-terrorism. It's only very recently that we've seen NATO defense budgets change and their priorities change in the last year and a half in response to Russian actions in Ukraine. So as we look forward and we move forward, and it's important to understand that the impact of Russian military form modernization is such that if you imagine these sort of dark scenarios, these hypothetical fights, Russians will be at a place, or at least they will believe, and I think they do believe that they're in a place, and that's what Zapad reflects to tie it back to what started our conversation here, that in a potential fight with a coalition of NATO countries, even as backed or led by the United States, they actually have some pretty good conventional military options in the initial period of war. They're not overmatched. They themselves might be the ones that have overmatched, and they can impose pretty high costs. And that's important to understand because Russians may not be planning to win any sort of conventional war with the United States, but if there is a crisis, either one that they provoked or somebody else provoked, suffice it to say, they do have a military that's not just designed for fighting with former Soviet republics. They have a military that's put them in a place where they believe, I think, that in a crisis, they could actually compel and coerce the United States, and they could manage the crisis such that it ends on relatively advantageous terms to them. All right? Beyond that, on the legitimacy question, that point, I would just very briefly add that I think one of the things that a lot of, to the extent you believe polling, but public opinion reflects, is that the one bright shining light that's associated with the regime today is the dramatic improvement of Russian armed forces and Russia's stature in the international arena, international system, right? And so I suspect that even though there will be cuts to Russia's defense budget, moving forward that the regime will still defend spending on their armed forces to the extent that they can, because that's basically one of their few good news stories, and I don't see public sentiment very much changing in that regard.
All right, well, gentlemen, we're obviously not going to resolve this issue here today, or else we'd all be making a lot more money than we make. So on that note, I guess we could wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the blog in Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been military analyst Michael Kaufman, a research scientist at the CNA Corporation, a fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. Thank you both for an enlightening and lively conversation.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.